So as was said in the introduction, I'm Corinne Graffunder. I work with the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. For the last 2 years, I've had the pleasure and privilege of working on behalf of the National Prevention Council in the development and now implementation of the National Prevention Strategy. I have materials that I hope you all are receiving, both postcards and then a fact sheet. We launched brand new materials on a revamped website just in the last day or so. So I would encourage you to go to the website and take a look, and hopefully it's good stuff there. I want to just give you some grounding as a basis for the rest of the presentation today. First of all, as was already said, the National Prevention Council is one of the sections that was included in the Affordable Care Act. And one of the things that I like to really try to help people understand is the significance of this section. You know, when people think about the Affordable Care Act, really one of the last things they're thinking about is the prevention provisions. They're thinking about the access issues. They're thinking about coverage. They're thinking about quality. They're thinking about cost. They're not thinking as much, and certainly the visibility has not been on the provisions that provide for prevention. And a little bias here, but I actually believe that one of the most powerful provisions is Section 4001, which did create the National Prevention Council. This council is made up of 17 federal departments. And what I would like you to help me, I would like to help you appreciate is the significance of having in law a standing infrastructure at the highest level of our government and across a number of sectors in our government that has been charged with not only developing the National Prevention Strategy, which is something we did, but now actually working to try to figure out how best to implement the strategy. So I'll come back to that in a few minutes, but I really want you to understand that while the strategy is an important product of the council, it is making this council a viable entity that can actually help represent leadership for prevention that I think is what the opportunity that the Affordable Care Act really created for us. So the National Prevention Strategy was and is the first product of the National Prevention Council, as I've said. And in a really simple drive-through of the National Prevention Strategy, obviously I don't have time to go through in great detail, I just want to give you a very quick overview and try to help you understand how it relates to the issue of the day, which is health equity. First of all, it is focused at its core on increasing health at every stage of life, right? And then the next thing that I want to help you understand is that as we went through the process with the Prevention Council, with the input from various stakeholders, it really became clear that there were a number of foundational aspects to prevention and to really all things and anything prevention. I mean, we're not going to be successful in our prevention efforts if we don't have healthy and safe community environments, if we don't have good, thoughtful, clinical and community, integrated clinical and community preventive services, if we're not empowering people to not only make their own personal health decisions, but giving them the context and the environment in which to do so, and charging them with demanding that those contexts be responsive to their needs. And then lastly, of course, as of interest today, the elimination of health disparities as a foundational part of the national strategy. So these four strategic directions are the foundation for everything that the strategy is based on. I like to say that the heart and soul of the strategy are social determinants of health and health in all policies. That really is, like I said, the heart and soul of the strategy. But we don't use that terminology in the actual strategy because that's public health jargon. We don't need to talk about health in all policies or social determinants of health. It's in the recommendations. It's in the review of what works that we represent those two concepts. So the last part of the strategy then that you'll find is that there are seven priorities. These seven priorities came from basically the law, that the law said that the strategy needed to address the leading causes of death. But it also did come from our listening to these 17 departments and hearing what they were saying when we said to them, what does prevention mean to you? What is your department? How does your department see prevention fitting into your agenda, your mission? And so anyway, the seven priorities are areas where we go further into the details of recommendations, evidence, priorities, etc. The second product that we then created, and I have one of each of them here with me today, we have the National Prevention Strategy, and then we have the National Prevention Council Action Plan. The Council Action Plan is critical, I believe. It was a second year of my life, so I definitely believe that it was critical to, because the National Prevention Strategy says that the federal government is going to do a number of things, but it doesn't go any further than that. We only had a year to write it, and we had a year to do meaningful work with 17 departments, so that was as far as we could do. The Council Action Plan takes it the next step and says, if the federal government said it was going to do these 78 things, what is being done? What is Homeland Security doing? What is the Department of Defense doing? And it codifies those commitments. In addition, it also codifies three broader commitments that all 17 departments have made commitments to around really accelerating prevention impact. I don't really have time to go into that, but if you have questions afterwards, I'd love to share more. But it was the idea is that individual departments can do individual things, and then collectively as a council, they're focused on some things collectively. I want to just touch on a couple of things. Let me go back for a second. On the National Prevention Strategy, in the elimination of health disparities section, it does make recommendations for for the elimination of health disparities. And I just want to give you a sense of what those look like. I should have put them on a slide, but I thought this was going to be so easy, and so no, it's not. Let's see. So the recommendations include ensuring a strategic focus on communities at greatest risk, reducing disparities in access to quality health care, increasing the capacity of the prevention workforce to identify and address disparities, supporting research to identify effective strategies to eliminate health disparities, and standardizing and data collection to better identify and address disparities. I read those to you for two reasons. One is that every one of those recommendation statements is then supported with the evidence that supports that being a recommendation, as well as in the strategic direction. The goal in creating the strategy was that the strategic direction stand alone, that they not talk about tobacco or about obesity or about, in each of the priorities, we also represent the issue of disparities. And in the introduction to the National Prevention Strategy, you will find that it calls out and says that this is fundamentally about equity and about trying to provide equal health for all Americans. I won't read them to you, but in the Council Action Plan, like I said, there are then specific actions in both the Elimination of Health Disparities section as well as the other sections that speak to what the council departments are doing. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Larry.
Sure.
Yeah, and the cards that I have in the back have the website on them, the website address, so you should be able to get to the website. We have an email box there as well if you want to send us a message and tell us something. Please do check it.
It's been such an exciting privilege to work with Corinne and the Surgeon General and others, but Corinne has been one of the most important thinkers in shaping the National Prevention Strategy. And I'm incredibly excited after this little election we have coming up next week to really then start to really escalate the work, to really move forward. The fact that we have a strategy to keep people from getting sick or injured or and I'm talking mentally and emotionally as well as physically, rather than waiting until after the fact. What I wanted to do today was talk about the National Prevention Council and strategy, the council being the 17 secretaries and their agencies that implement, but particularly from the perspective of social work. Since this is the Social Work Caucus, people often remark when I speak, if I do a good job, people come up and say, I'm very, very proud that you like me, I'm a social worker. And so I thought it would be important to share some of the important social work, social welfare perspectives that really advance health reform. First, here's the picture of the signing that Corinne showed a minute ago, but with the words, in the absence of a radical shift toward prevention and public health, we will not be successful in containing medical costs or improving the health of the American people. And there are a number of opportunities in health reform, the prevention strategy being strategically in the middle, but also community clinic expansion, the Center for Medicaid and Medicare expansion, and all the work that we've been excited to be part of with community transformation grants, which built on the communities putting prevention to work elements of the stimulus. And this work is not only about keeping people healthy, but it's about creating a viable, new, multi-ethnic, equitable workforce that's working in communities across the country, particularly the most disenfranchised, one of the issues that in social work we fully understand. So just as a reminder, behaviors and environments, genetics, medical care. One of these is 70% of the factors influencing health. One is 20, one is 10. Which is 70? Behavior and environment. I get a different answer in, when I speak to medical groups. Which is 20? Medical care. How many people say medical care, not gene? How many people say genetics? And that's the right answer. So with behavior and environment, which I would describe as the areas most amenable to prevention, and I think we're learning about things like epigenetics, that these things really are interrelated even more than we thought, and that our environments and our behaviors that start to affect our genes and vice versa. But of the is 70% of the funding for prevention, behavior and environment, is that 70% of our national health expenditures? Should be, right, based on this? Maybe it's 50, 40. What do you think? What number? Give me a number. 10? Jean shaking her head again. Approximately 3%. These are old numbers, but it's always 3 to 4%. And even with health reform, we're not changing those numbers, or at least we're not changing them yet, but maybe in the next generation. So one of the most important skills that came from my social work background is collaboration skills. Another is really understanding equity and context. I diagnosed abdominal pain when the real problem was hunger. I confused social issues with medical problems in other patients too. I had neither the skills nor the resources for treating them, so I ignored the social context of disease altogether. She wrote this in the San Francisco Chronicle. I thought it was a very brave and very important statement, particularly from a physician, to really put things in context. But also, of course, we're talking about inequities. I love this quote from Nancy Krieger, and I'll show you why in a minute. The health inequities we see are not about just individual bad choices. They're about things not being fair. And that's something we need to come to terms with. And finally, I think as social workers, we really understand environment. We understand the links between environment and health and safety when we think about air, water, soil. But we equally, I think, have information of tremendous importance to the national prevention strategy when we think about how the environment shapes behavior, and that too affects health and safety. And I said finally, but of course also, we understand policy. And we understand the links between the individual and the policy. Now when I was introduced, you mentioned that I did the country's first multi-city no smoking laws. Let me quickly give you two pieces of information about that relate to my social work background. The first is that shortly after bringing Cancer Heart and Lung Associations together, I sat down with a guy from a group I'd never heard of called the Tobacco Institute. I should have guessed better what he was doing when he immediately called me up and said, can we go to the fanciest restaurant in town? It's a long story, and we actually have a video on YouTube about it if any of you are interested. It's really great and inspiring for people who haven't had policy experience. But basically what he said to me is, Larry, I love your work. The tobacco work's really important. And he offered 4,000 car seats to me if I cared about that, which I did. Or also he'd like me to come work for him, and he offered to triple my salary right like that. And not to stop doing tobacco work, not to stop doing prevention, just that dirty, distasteful, controversial policy work. So that's when I knew policy is what it's all about. That's when I knew we were really on the right track. And clearly we were, and clearly he was right, because in California now, the percentage of smokers is less than half of it, what it was when we had that conversation. A few months later, to my shocking surprise, I got a call from the Office of the Secretary of Health and Human Services. I was very new in my career, and the secretary spoke to me and said, Larry, you're winning the National Health Promotion Award. I said, well, this is crazy. I've just started my career. I've been looking around for mentors and leaders. You must be mistaken. And they said, no, because you've brought the notion of partnerships and collaboration to public health, a whole new concept. And I had to say, well, for public health, perhaps it is a whole new concept, but it's just basic social welfare work. It comes out of my training in group therapy. There was nothing magical or surprise. I didn't even really think about it. Though dealing with the turf issues of cancer, heart, and lung associations is hard. It was harder than my previous work in a psychiatric halfway house trying to get the patients to get along. So very quickly, I want to share four or five ideas with you. The first is this environment idea and partnership. I often show these slides, what's health got to do with it. And as you look at it, think, does this environment affect behavior? And also think, what partners do we need to fix it? America's top model thought somehow violence is a nice photo shoot. This was an old General Motors ad they were showing in every college campus. Hey, you're creepy if you use public transit. They had another one where a young man was being laughed at by a young woman in a car because he was on a bicycle. I like the new General Motors, by the way. This is the old General Motors. Here's a series from Orange County, one of the wealthiest counties in California, but the low-income part of it. Photos taken by Latino Health Access. Young boy comes out of the apartment with his sister. They say, let's go play. No playing allowed in the courtyard. So they go to the park. And so where do they end up? In the dumpster. We understand this is untenable. We understand all the different health, mental health, social justice issues here and what it takes and what the partners are to fix it. Again, social work skills, just human skills. I wanted to end with this one to cheer you up a little bit. It's unreasonable to expect that people will change their behavior easily when so many forces in the social, cultural, and physical environment conspire against such change. It's unreasonable that we're going to change. This is the context. When our context, our environment, conspires against our behaviors, I think we understand that. I wanted to talk for a minute about equity. This, of course, is our Bay Area symbol, but this bridge, which has taken 30 years to dismantle since the last earthquake, still not fixed yet. But this bridge brings us to Oakland, you know, a far more vibrant, crowded, that's where our office is, on the right on the other side of the bay. A young African-American child born in West Oakland, you know, in one of the less high-income areas, a young white boy born in the Oakland Hills, wealthy, but not really wealthy, just a lot wealthier. There's a 15-year difference in life expectancy between one and the other. For every $12,000 in family income, an additional year. That's why you're seeing the signs out here which say APHA, but were paid for by California Endowment, because Tony Eitan, who's the vice president now, was our health officer in Oakland and Alameda County at the time, that say it's not your genetic code, it's your zip code. That's the determinant. So we need to build health and equity into all policies, and this is the genius of the work that Corinne has been so involved in, and all these partnerships. We need to form broader partnerships to meet mutual goals. I'm actually a little cynical about the notion of health in all policies, because other groups aren't necessarily interested in health. We want to partner with educators to get kids physically active. Well, of course they care about health, but what they really care about is when kids aren't physically active, their test scores are going to be lower. They're going to be less effective in their daily schoolwork. So it's the win-win situation. And, you know, Corinne showed this list of 17 agencies. But we don't always have to get things from 17. It could be 2, it could be 3, it could be 5. So we developed this tool called Collaboration Multiplier. Here's an example with 4 sectors we might want to see work together. Here's the tool, and I'm just going to do this very quick to give you the background that it exists. I hope you use it. So we'll say, what's the expertise of public health? What's its outcomes, you know, that it wants to achieve? What are some of its key strategies? We'll fill that in. We'll fill that in for all these different groups. Then we'll say, so what's the significance of that? And then we'll look, for example, at the strengths of different partners in terms of different connections to programs and services, and they can start to prepare joint strategies, like in this case, healthy food procurement strategies, which I'd really like to see become national policy. I'm sick and tired of going to CDC meetings, Corinne, that are outside of anywhere where you can walk to a decent restaurant and the food is not appropriately healthy. You know, it's not hard to fix that, and we all have to insist on it. I've been talking with a number of people who speak around the country, and one of them said to me the other day, before I speak, I say, what are you going to be serving? And I said, you know, we should sign a pact as speakers that we're going to ask that question every single time, and if they want us to be speakers at major conferences, we're going to insist on that, and we should catalyze that nationally. So then it fills in, and you start to have a strategy. Very quick and dirty, but I just wanted to share it with you. An incredibly important piece, and this comes from our work with community clinics and Center for Medicaid and Medicare, although we've been almost religious, I would say, at Prevention Institute in not working with medical care, because everybody else's, they need to be a focal point on prevention. We started to say, how do we combine prevention and health services? And we have this paper in the executive summaries in the back, I hope you'll pick it up, called Community-Centered Health Homes. You know, we talked about medical homes, and then the new innovation is patient-centered medical homes. What an innovation. You mean if there are 3 different doctors treating me, they're all going to know about the medicine I take? I mean, that's great, but that's kind of basic, right? So how about if we expand that and say, how do we think about community context? Since every single PowerPoint I've shown says the community is such an important way of determining health. It comes from the work of people like Jack Geiger, community-oriented primary care. He went to work in Mississippi, a 6-county farm, and he said to the pharmacist, you better start expanding your pharmacy and think about food, because I'm going to be writing prescriptions for fruits and vegetables. And of course, the federal government called them on the carpet and said, what on earth are you doing? You cannot write prescriptions for fruits and vegetables. So he took out the physician's desk reference and said, the last time we looked, the specific therapy for malnutrition was food. One of the great heroes of my life, one of my teachers at the medical school when it partnered with the social work school. And an example of it in Oakland, Chinatown, was that the Asian Pacific Islander health clinic, the father of a board member was killed crossing the street. And they started to say, wait a minute, what's going on? And I know when I'm driving, this is just a photo, it's usually incredibly crowded. I'm looking to the left as I may, or to the right as I'm turning left, and then there are people crossing willy-nilly, even the ones obeying the law, and other people are jaywalking and running. And so they said, let's have the lights go this way first, then this way, then stop, and the people can cross. And there's been a dramatic reduction. That's people in healthcare saying, let's look at what's going on in the community and fix it, instead of continuing the stream of saying, sick person after sick person after sick person. A lot of it is housing. We've got people with asthma. Why don't we clear up the molds for everyone? We got people with lead poisoning. We got people with rat bites. There are so many ways we can move this work forward in the next administration. I wanted to share this one too, which is because in my work on community transformation grants, there's been tremendous criticism of the grants in terms of one of the biggest examples. They're giving grocers refrigerators. What a stupid thing to do. What does that have to do with health? What an outrage. So we turn this into a 3-part picture, and it starts out there, and then we say, well, this is what it ends up looking like. And this is the norms change we're talking about. How dare you tell me that's not health? What could be a better expenditure than that? I just want to show you we've made some progress. This is an old photo. Another one, it wasn't just the doctors, it was the dentists. And now we have this photo. That's the third smoker we've lost this week. Somebody recently criticized me for that photo. They said, Larry, that's a picture of people smoking way too close to the window. That's just not allowable. And here in San Francisco, they've banned tobaccos in pharmacies, and I'm very, very proud of it. And one of my other goals is, can't we get junk food out of pharmacies? But I did want to say to you, for those of us in Oakland and Alameda County, working with a great member of the Board of Supervisors there, we just passed a law requiring the pharmaceutical companies to take back the pharmaceuticals that otherwise we pour down the drain to create antibiotic resistance and pollution. Or we keep there, and when we keep them there, the reason I got involved is someone approached me after a talk I gave in Idaho saying her daughter had killed herself. She was very depressed. She was already on medication. She went to her boyfriend's house and took every medication in the medicine chest. Obviously a very complex issue, but why don't we get the medicines back? Why don't we, you know, and the pharmaceutical company said, oh, we can't afford that. I was talking to someone from Germany this morning who said, well, that's just standard practice in Europe. But we all know in terms of healthcare, Europe's much, much worse than the United States, and we shouldn't pay any attention to their practices. So that's the theory. But as my mentor, Yogi Berra, said, in theory, there's no difference in theory and practice. But in practice, there is. So you're left with the practice. And sooner or later, all this talk, APHA, comes to an end, and we're going to get back to work. Prevention Institute is about strategies for people. It's about tools. An example is a 2-minute video about how food industry is lying to get you to buy unhealthy food for kids. The same in the same length of video as an ad, we make the case. There's a postcard in the back of the room if you didn't get one already. We've got a lot more work to do, but we're building a movement. We're building it together. And if we work together and keep pushing, the kind of changes I've shown you with tobacco, and I could talk about car seats, and I could talk about DUI, there's so many, and in every single case I've been told, it's impossible. And it's always impossible, and then we get it done. Thank you all very much.